Okie dokie, yeah, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Christian Corley, this is James McLean, and, well, we're going to talk about the Big Dots Who News this week. There's another chat later on after this, in which James and I welcome Simon Daines and James Baldock to the podcast with a K team, and we're having a nice fun chat, but before we get
more
to that...
More importantly, it's really about you saying that there's no Doctor Who news at the moment. Which is going to be throughout that chat, this whole idea there's no Doctor Who news, which utterly goes against the first part of the same podcast, which is all about the Doctor Who news that has been breaking this week.
Yeah, basically, we recorded the podcast a day early. If we'd have recorded it on today, you know, we'd have had this to talk about, which would have been a very different podcast. So the BBC has released details. Well, details isn't really the right word. A photo of Jodie Whittaker dressed as Mork from Mork and the new police box. It's the look of the 13th Doctor and the TARDIS.
Yeah.
It's striking, I'll give it that. And she looks okay. And I'm not swung by it in either direction. What do you think? I mean, I'm not a fashion expert, so I'm probably not... You know, I just throw things on.
It's doing the vogue at the moment, which has certainly been a vogue in BBC productions over the last 7-8 years. The coloured pants, if you notice, is a very similar sort of bluey teal that you would see in Ripper Street.
Right,
and
yeah.
Musketeers. They work very well, I think, with the filters and the complementary colours. You've got the goldy braces, which again, as we say, you know, teal and gold are sort of very primary filters used in television and film at the moment, so it's unsurprising that they would sort of be the things which are being blasted out of her outfit there. I don't mind it. It's arguably a little pretentious, but then obviously the Doctor's often has been, but I've never been over keen on that. I think it was all right for Baker, in the sense that his was quite wildly bohemic compared to what the rest were previous.
Hmm.
But then I kind of felt that they needed to sort of pull back a bit, and then that would allow it to be his own identity rather than the sort of crazy costumes which sort of became the thing certainly up until McGann. And then obviously they filtered down a bit for Russell T. Davies's era. So, yeah, I don't mind. The coat's kind of interesting. It does look like that might be a hood again, and I liked the hood on the teaser reveal. I thought that was nice. So it looks quite elegant in terms of its designing, and it looks quite fashionable in the sense that it looks its own thing. It doesn't. When you consider Eccleston, Tennant, and to some degree Capaldi sort of mirrored fashions that were sort of established, this feels a little more cut to her. I quite like it in its own way. In the same time, like I said, I kind of preferred the sort of more pulled back teaser reveal thing of the darkness and the hood. I just thought that seemed to be quite dignified. I think that's probably what I don't like about it, is it's obviously meant to be sort of a little zany, and I quite like the idea of the Doctor having a little more of a dignified vibe to them.
Well,
we've had so many zanies.
Yeah, well, as vibes go, I'm definitely getting Mork and Mindy from it.
But yeah, there is a bit of that.
With the striped sweater and the braces.
I assume the striped is more a homage to the striped scarf.
Perhaps, but, yes. And it's also in the lining of the coat by the look of things as well.
Yeah, could be, yes, I think you're right, yes. So it's quite nice, as something designed specifically for her, it's quite nice. It's nicer than what was designed specifically for Peter Davison. It's got a better cut, it feels more professional. She's got a dignity in it. I quite like it. I also quite like the way that she's carrying herself in these photos so far, and of course they're not indicative of how she'll be as a performer. But there's a sort of quiet confidence in the shots. There's no sort of grimace or sort of a feel of enigma that you'd get in Capaldi's shot. The sort of standoffishness of Eccleston, or even slightly standoffish of Tennant. This is sort of quite the same as she was in the teaser. So I'm wondering whether this is an idea of what she's going to be like. And I also wonder if the backgrounds meant to be indicative again of a sort of tone of what she is. That might not be.
I saw something on Twitter, I'm not sure who it was, and I'm not sure how accurate it was, but there was some suggestion that one of the rocks was CGI'd in to cover up something else that's often found in fields. But as I say, I don't know how accurate that is.
No, but I mean, aside from that, so we need to sort of turn our attention to the police box.
Yes. Now, I've seen a lovely version of this photo where someone is CGI'd in the, or pasted in, the Barnet Bypass police box.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think of this? How does it sit for you as a police box, as police boxes go?
I'm a little mixed on it. I mean, it's a shame Brian's not here to throw in his. In fact, in some ways, it's not dissimilar to Brian's prop in some of its look, sort of colour in the windows. There's a sort of, to me, feels like an amalgam of the sort of the Peter Davison to McCoy era with elements of the Eccleston dropped in, and what might be, by the looks of it, the Capaldi light.
Right.
You've also got a McGann police box pull to open door thing where the handle's on the other side.
Yes.
Interesting, quite a low handle as well, which might suggest, I don't know whether that suggests the size is about the same as before and the handle's a little lower because she's not particularly tall. And then you've got this sort of, again, same sort of contrast of having this sort of blue, tealy blue with the gold windows, so you're going to get that same complementary vibe going on there. I'm not, the one thing that I really don't like, there's two things I don't particularly like about it. One is it still looks a bit square, windows look a bit square. I have a feeling it's still going to be a little fat. Okay, that's life. I don't like the dark blue police box sign on the light blue finish.
Okay,
that looks really weird to me, to have that sort of that blue with the greeny blue. I mean, again, we're picking for the sake of a podcast, not that, as I say, this is like the end of Doctor Who as we know it and we won't watch it. It's just a little fascinating. Looks almost like it's actually got something to the pillars at the bottom as well. Like they've got a slight sort of cut-off, I'm not sure.
Well, it's funny, because I've zoomed into the photo a bit to get a better look at the police box.
Yeah.
And the thing that strikes me is it doesn't look physical once I've zoomed in.
I am told that is the police box.
Right.
So it is the thing.
Right. It's the text seems to be slightly wonky on it, as if it's been written in.
Interesting.
On a computer. Ooh. So. Because
I'm told that insiders have seen the police box.
I wonder if they've. What probably the case is then that they're not in the same studio together.
Oh, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
It definitely, yeah. I think there's a lot of amalgamationing there. No, it's an odd, and that may be why it's all police box looks kind of odd. I don't know. Maybe because the sort of the way it's all plateaued and layered, it just doesn't quite work. The distances, possibly. I don't know.
Perhaps as well, just to accentuate this point a bit further.
Yeah.
Everything in the photo is in focus, except some of the writing on the police box and the right edge as well. So it could be that, and it could be a lot about the police box that is more to be seen, I should think.
Yeah, so I think the next reveal will be the console room, which will be interesting to see what they do with that. I think that's very much under wraps at the moment.
But there's a lot of talk about it going back to the 60s, wasn't there, at one point?
Yes. Yes. Oh, no, that's interesting. I just found a sort of a better high-res version of that police box. I quite like some of the detail on it, I must say. Some extra details. Like I say, those pillars have got slight sort of weird cut-off indents at the top and at the bottom.
And at the bottom, yeah, yeah.
And you've got this sort of, you've got the return to the very definitive stepped bit above the windows, which I think is quite nice. It has a look of, it does have a little bit of a feel of the Yardley Jones one, as I say, with a little more squareness from the ones currently. And that roof looks more sort of Yardley Jones sort of Doctor 5 size as well. So, I mean, it's just quite interesting to see as a prop. It looks like they've gone back to sort of like the Pertwee era police call, a pull to open thing as well. That wording looks... So, yeah, quite interesting. Quite.
Quite interesting, yes. QI.
Well, it depends, doesn't it? It depends on people. It depends on what people like, what people find interesting. Some people, as I've heard many times, say, well, it's just a box. To some, it's something a little fresh, a little different. And for collectors, obviously, it's a big, big thing. So,
well, you know, yeah. A lot of people throw around a word beginning with I these days. But in terms of, certainly within terms of British culture and Doctor Who, particularly, the police box is iconic. It instantly yes. describes the it's instantly recognisable, it's instantly part of the show. It puts you in mind instantly of Doctor Who. So it is a key part of the show.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So, and all the different designs work in different ways
It's something, it's something they feel very big on, in the sense that we've got such very different police boxes for the Twice Upon a Time. They've gone and had a very accurate remake of the police box as it was at the end of the Hartnell era to go next to the Capaldi one.
Yeah.
And the differences are quite striking, which, yeah, people can say, I don't care, it's just a police box, that's absolutely fine, but the aesthetics are interesting. And the historical nature, I think people like that. And I think when you have something which is as long-running as Doctor Who, you have people enjoying to see these elements which date or mark particular eras of the show. I think that's a part of it as well. They sort of become landmark bits. And that police box now, as it has been more recently, will be very much linked with Capaldi. It won't be linked with Whittaker. Same with console rooms. People find out with console rooms as well. So, yeah, I think it's interesting that it's not anywhere near a Metropolitan police box. I'm a little surprised at that. I thought they were going to hit something a little more realistic, and they seem to have gone for something which is a little more of a homage to the old show, which is fine.
So for the uninitiated, how would a Metropolitan police box be different? Would it be taller?
Yeah, I would say it would be narrow. It'd certainly be taller. The roof would be taller. The windows tended to be more rectangular and smaller in the actual frames. The colour was darker. The base tended to be a little more pronounced because it was usually a concrete base, so
yeah.
That carried. There are elements that you'd see on the sort of Metropolitan box, or the generic considered Metropolitan box on the Capaldi one. Obviously, the white rimmed windows was a common feature, as was the St. Ambulance. St. John's Ambulance badge was a common feature too. The lights tended to be a little more thicker and stubbier. I mean, essentially, if you go and watch the Cushing film,
yes.
That is the closest thing there is that they've done so far to the Metropolitan box. And if you don't like that box, then you'll be glad that they're not using it. But that is the closest, not the most, it's still not accurate, but it's closest to the sort of Met design. But they did vary in themselves. So, yeah, it's fine. I'm kind of surprised we spent more time talking about the box than the actual costume, but I suppose there's only so much you can say about the costume.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, anything to add?
No, I was just going to say I quite like the braces / suspenders, depending on what side of the Atlantic you come from. So I think what I like about the costume is that it is very unfussy, yet it is very busy at the same time. You know, with the Doctor, up until the new series, certainly there was a busyness, wasn't there, about the outfits, bar maybe Davison's. But that sort of has almost like a stripped down idea of those elements of the old outfits, perhaps. I'm sure the comic artists must be thrilled looking at that, because that's going to be quite nicely easy to render.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of good illustrations already, so...
Maybe we'll talk about the comics later.
Maybe we should, yes, maybe we should. So that winds up James and I's brief chat about the new look for the new Doctor and the new look for the old TARDIS, if you can put it that way. It doesn't really matter either way, does it? James will now become Jim, and we're And, you know, here comes the main event. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a podcast with a K. Actually, it's not the podcast with a K. It's a podcast with two Jameses. I'm Christian Corley. And with me this week, as per last week, which was a few days ago, which is later on today when I publish it, is Simon Daines.
Hello.
James Baldock.
Hello.
And James / Jim for shortness and possibly distinguishment, McLean.
Hello.
I'm looking at all your faces on Skype, only I'm not, because one of you is kind of a blue default, one of you is a hat, and one of you is gurning, and it's reminding me of that moment on the 11th hour when the Doctor Skypes Patrick Moore and all those other clever people.
Yeah.
Not quite the same impact, but nevertheless.
That's not a blue default, that's actually my face.
Oh dear.
I will have you take that back, that remark. Thank you very much.
Is there a channel? Have you got a Channel 5 documentary dedicated to you?
I've got a series. Never mind documentary.
So we're here to talk Doctor Who. Well, we were going to be talking Doctor Who, and then we thought, well, there's not enough, a lot of Doctor Who around at the moment. And then we had a look and thought, actually, there is quite a bit of Doctor Who around at the moment. But we are living in this kind of strange netherworld of there being very little news to speak of. It's nearly Christmas, and I have absolutely no doubt that even by the time this podcast has gone out, but certainly by the end of this month, there will be a lot of Doctor Who PR material going out for the Christmas special, because it's November. Yeah. I just want to repeat that. It's November. That's more for my benefit with having three children than anyone else's. There's this... there's very little to speak of, other than, you know, the Bradley Walsh thing that we discussed a couple of weeks ago. There's very little going on, and it's quite strange to have such...
Wasn't he that clown in Sarah Jane?
Say that again?
But Bradley Walsh, he was that clown in Sarah Jane, wasn't he?
He was, yes.
Has he been in the news?
Yeah, it was Halloween a few days ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So obviously Bradley Walsh has been confirmed as being cast in Doctor Who along with
I'm tremendously excited by that.
We can all tell. So, but there is a few things happening. I think the first one we'll get out of the way, because it's kind of inconsequential for many, but it also is a bit of it's indicative of what's going on in Doctor Who at the moment. A few months ago, Doctor Who Adventures was cancelled until 2018. And we've just heard this past few weeks that Titan Comics' series of Doctor Who comics is coming to a pause for a few months. So each ongoing series is coming to its natural end, and it will remain naturally ended until Doctor Who kicks off again in 12 months' time. 10 months' time, whatever. Any of you guys read the comics?
No.
Sorry.
Okay, well, I do from time to time. They are quite good. I think they're better than they have been in the past. I think it's a bit of a shame, but at the same time, comics are very much... For a TV series, I think comics are very much... A take it or leave it, aren't they? They're never a must-have. They're just like a nice thing on the side. Yeah. So... In many ways, it's a surprise they've lasted so long.
Yeah. I remember getting TV Action and Countdown in the 70s, when that was John Pertwee on the covers. And they were very good. They had some jolly good stories, and the artwork was brilliant. And so you got your sort of double whammy of Doctor Who on the Saturday morning when TV Action arrived on the doorstep, and then you would watch Frontier in Space in the evening, or... No, it was earlier than that, wasn't it? It was sort of Terror of the Autons time. Anyway, there you are. Thought I'd throw that in. They don't make them like that anymore.
Well, no, they don't, because they're very... they try to be both... I think in those days, those comics, because we've all seen those, and they were very honest in that they weren't trying to be too clever, were they? They were just giving you a quick adventure in two pages or whatever. I think these days... I mean, I haven't read... at length the Titans, but I've read a few of them. I particularly read the Fourth Doctor 5-part serial, which was very good, but it couldn't resist, the writers couldn't sort of steer it away from a bit of kind of being self-indulgent, really.
Yeah. And in what way?
In several ways. Most notably, making clever in jokes in references, yeah. which for me are the worst kind of self indulgence.
Yes,
because they take you out of it.
The difference is that TV comic and the likes were really primarily made at a wider audience. While if you're doing a sort of Doctor Who magazine or Doctor Who comic, you're aiming at people who are going to be looking for specific nuances than you would with something which is, oh, there was the Busby episode, now it's the Daleks. He says, mixing up his various 70s comic strips. But you know what I mean? It was a broader comic demographic, which I think is why they were a little less...
Yeah. I do think they could try to be a bit less flabby, I think is the word I'm looking for. I don't know. I think we missed that whole TV action or going further back, the Eagle sort of attitude to storytelling, where just like get the story told, get it out there. 2000 AD still do it with their Future Shocks. I know this because I'm trying to write one at the moment.
Yeah.
And they tell you to basically take a 30-page American comic and compress it into 4 pages. And you know, so you're getting rid of the flab. You're just getting the story told and finished with a twist. So you get quickly to it, and then you've got to start working the whole flipping the page for a surprise. I just find it all does seem to be a bit self-indulgent, but you know, what do I know?
Well, I read Hunters of the Burning Stone a while back.
I liked that. I thought that was good.
I did until we got to the end, because I mean, I can just about believe some of the twists that they had in it, but it was when you got to, I mean, I'm going to ruin it for anybody who hasn't read it now, and I have no apologies for that. But when you got to the end and you found out that the Tribe of Gum were behind the whole thing, and that the reason the TARDIS was the way it was because the 11th Doctor had deliberately gone back and sabotaged it so that it remained in this shape so that they could get a convenient fix for a massive world-changing problem that was occurring at the end of the story. I think I was banging my head against the wall and thinking, this is just so much... Can I say fan wank? Is that okay? Because it was. It read like bad fan wank. And... I just thought there's got to be a more streamlined way of telling a story than this. And maybe I'm not the right audience for this. Maybe because as far as I can gather, the kids loved it.
This was in DWM, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's a different kettle of fish, but it's comics in general. As you say, there is a flabbiness in general for a lot of the comic stories. It always feels like some of the writers, I mean, this is going to sound dreadful, it feels like some of the writers are almost trying to audition, and they're writing scripts rather than just telling decent stories.
Yeah.
I think also there was a sort of movement in the sort of late 80s, 90s where visuals in comics became a far more dominant force. And what I just like about the 70s and 80s in comics, where you'd have, I think we've said this before, Christian, we have multiple panels rather than larger splashes, larger reveals, and it meant that the sort of story and the sort of flow that panels give you as a sequential tale became a more sort of, you sort of could enjoy each segment rather than it being sort of very big panel splashes, which would, you wouldn't have there wouldn't be so much of a sequence to it because that one big thing would be telling you everything at once. And I kind of miss that engagement. And I think you start, and that goes across comics in general, including 2000 AD started doing it. But that's what I like about things like the Dan Dare, is you get these very compressed spaces of dialogue and movement, often in a small story, but it feels more like you're getting some more out of it. I don't know.
No, I'd agree with that. I used to, my dad is of a vintage of buying the Eagle when they first came out, and then when he left school, got a job, joined the Navy, threw his Eagles away. So in the late 80s, he was buying all these quite expensive reprint books, and I'd sit there and read them, and I was, you know, I'd absolutely race through them because, you know, you get on with the story. There's no messing about, and then you've got this beautiful artwork and all this amazing vehicle and gun and gadget design and everything else that's going on, and obviously the alien planets and the alien worlds and the whole, just everything about them is absolutely lovely. But yeah, you push on the story, so I absolutely agree with what you're saying there, James. So yeah, comics. Maybe this is a topic we can come back to at some point in the future. But We're going to move on because...
Can I just say, I think Dan Dare is seriously due a revival of some sort. They have to bring him back, give him his own TV series or something, and there's got to be a market for it.
I think there's currently an audio series, isn't there? But yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
I think Big Finish. Does Big Finish do it?
I think if it's not Big Finish, it's someone connected to Big Finish or someone who has worked with Big Finish in the past. Yeah, but there is a Dan Dare audio, and I think I may have seen some artwork. I don't know if there's a current comic run. There's been a few comic runs recently in the past 10 years. I know there was a Virgin one, but maybe we could do. Oh, excuse me, my voice is going. Maybe we could chat in depth about Dan Dare at some point in the future.
Yeah.
That would be fun. But we'll move on because there are rumours about... I don't know if this has actually been confirmed, but there has been some naughtiness at the hands of... from the hands of a Dalek operator. Nicholas Pegg. And it has been suggested, although I don't think it's been explicitly stated, that he'll no longer be driving Daleks.
Yes.
So, whether or not that's the case, we don't know. But basically what happened, you may have seen this. We're just going to give you a few thoughts on it from ourselves. Basically,
you drive a Dalek? Is that the right verb?
Well, yeah, I think you push it along with your feet, don't you?
Scuffle? Do you scuffle a Dalek?
Scuffle's a very good word. Yes, it could well be scuffle.
So. Perambulate.
Well, you can't say fairer than that, can you? Pram-a-Dalek. Yeah, so Nicholas Pegg was the Watcher. I didn't know this until the other day, so that's that ruined for me. Now I know who the Watcher was. Damn it.
I always assumed it was Nicholas Briggs, actually, but so I was surprised it wasn't.
Yeah, I thought
and
it
I
was...
And I used to like the column as well. It's a shame it's gone.
You were close, though.
Yeah, I got the
Dalek
first name.
Daleks and Nicholas.
It had to be somebody
who knew his stuff.
Definitely did. No, I was going to say, I once gave it some thought a few years ago, and I thought perhaps it was Gareth Roberts, but...
That would have fitted.
Yeah, but no, obviously, clearly we now know it was Nicholas Pegg. And under the pen name of Watcher, he launched his extraordinary attack on BBC Worldwide. I think you all know what BBC Worldwide do. And Panini, who are the publishers of Doctor Who magazine. And there's a coded message in the current edition of Doctor Who magazine. Basically, I think it's the first letter of each paragraph spells out a message.
First letter of each sentence, actually.
Each sentence, beg your pardon.
Because I sat down with a highlighter pen and worked it out.
Did you photocopy it first, or have you got a ruined copy of DWM?
No, I've got a ruined copy of DWM. I only keep them in the loo, anyway.
Fair enough.
You may not wish to know that.
No, I think
it's we've too much information.
Yeah, we're past that point now.
Especially with the Gurning picture, can I just add that?
Panini and BBC Worldwide are a naughty word beginning with C. And it isn't crap. Although, anyway, so yeah, he's been moved on from Panini. And, you know, it's probably made a lot more column inches than it probably should have done, except for the fact that it does seem to be kind of a self-destructive kind of action. I'm not sure. I mean, it's like, you know, we've heard a few days ago that the leader of the free world lost his Twitter account for 11 minutes, and the person responsible for that is kind of was already leaving their job. This guy wasn't already leaving his job, and yet he's sabotaged possibly two careers, which seems utterly baffling to me.
Well, I mean, there was talk in private eye about this.
The
and again, this is all unconfirmed, but the speculation is that it all stems back to Thomas Billsbury, who of course was the editor of DWM for years until he left earlier this year. And I always found that action a little odd, the fact that he suddenly went like that.
And
of course, the rumour is that this stems from BBC Worldwide very much clamping down on some of the things that DWM have been saying, particularly about a certain spin-off which came out last year and has not gone down as well as we thought. And they picked up on things in that they said about that, and also used particular interviewee comments as examples of political bias. And Panini, in response to this, I think they made all their freelancers go on a training course or something like that. Anyway, and Spilsbury got gardening leave. That's the story as has been reported. It's important to note that this is still rumour. Now, Marcus Hearn comes in. I love Marcus Hearn. The book is a fantastic book. Marcus Hearn is the new editor. I'm wondering whether at this point Nicholas Pegg had just had enough and decided, well, my days are numbered anyway, probably, and if you're going to go out in style. I mean, as you say, Christian, he has basically sabotaged his career, but maybe he felt it was done anyway and just wanted to go out on a high, or what he perceived as a high. That's my personal take on it. Mm. I think there's absolutely no way you would do this and not expect to get caught. You know what Doctor Who fans are like. They're the most pedantic, clue-seeking people of the lot.
Especially reading that page.
We're always looking for patterns that aren't there, to quote the Eighth Doctor.
Yeah.
So I think he must have known this would get found out and that he'd be out on his heel, assuming that's happened. Again, we don't yet know he's been sacked, but I think it's very likely that he will be.
If that report is true, I find it rather odd, because I often find Doctor Who magazine is a very irritating read, because this fawning adulation
of
a lot of mediocrity. Absolutely. A lot of the time. And now, Beaumarchais in The Marriage of Figaro, a text with which I'm sure we're all familiar, one of the characters in that, set in 1784, one of the characters in that says, without the liberty to criticise, no praise has any value. And if you're just going to say that every bit of tosh that is whammed out for a season filler in a Capaldi Doctor Who is the most wonderful piece of television ever produced on any planet ever, anywhere ever, it just becomes silly. I got very fed up with the sort of fawning adulation that you got in DWN, so I'm quite surprised that BBC Worldwide actually want more of it rather than less of it. I mean, I think the glory days of DWN were in when Gary Gillett was editor, and it was actually a very funny and witty magazine as well, and mildly took the mickey out of a lot of the series, rather than treating it as a sort of piece of holy writ. I think, too, that Pegg... I did wonder whether Pegg's punishment fitted the crime, but then I thought, well, I guess if you are going to include that particular word, which, of course, I had to look up in a dictionary to understand what it meant, because it's not a word I've heard or used... that if you are going to put that particular word in a magazine that is read by impressionable young people and by old geeks like me, that maybe a parting of the ways is appropriate. I'm not sure why it means he has to stop being a Dalek either. It's not as if Daleks wander around uttering that particular word. Maybe they do. They must get really pissed off by being enclosed in those metal shells all the time, mustn't they?
Yes.
Yes.
It doesn't bear thinking about.
It doesn't. It must be very claustrophobic.
You could be right, Simon. I mean, it's certainly DWM does have this reputation for, you call it falling adulation. I'd say probably covering their own backs.
Yeah, probably.
And I'm not saying that's a good or a bad thing, but I'm thinking it's possibly the only course they feel able to take. I mean, and we're in a climate where Doctor Who is still very much a part of the TV landscape at the moment, and in order to remain in that circle, sometimes you have to be a little more enthusiastic about things than perhaps you want to.
But did you know in 1980, it was, I think, still Doctor Who Weekly then, there were complaints about the fact that when they had letters on the... It was before the Rights to Frobisher pages. But on the letters page, they would edit the letters so that any criticism either of the programme or of the magazine was cut. And they got hammered for that. So it's interesting that, the wheel seems to have come full circle.
Which was also on in 1980.
That's true, yeah.
It's probably worth mentioning at this point that Doctor Who magazine is, and I have checked this and double checked this, and I can't find anything that contradicts me, so if anyone does know anything different to me, whether it's anyone who I'm virtually sat with or anyone listening, as far as I can ascertain, Doctor Who magazine remains the only BBC licensed magazine that is not published by Immediate Media. So they are kind of out on their own at Panini in some ways.
Yeah.
But this was one of the things that Pegg was allegedly annoyed about, was that when Spilsbury went, bringing in Hearn came from an editorial background which was felt not to fit the character of the magazine, and felt that this was again a more sort of internal political sort of manoeuvring of editors. But I mean, I think there's two things I think there's an issue here. One, I think we need to accept also that while we can say that this was a deliberate attack, by the laws of probability, there is a chance this is just entirely coincidence that it spelled that out. And I am surprised. I am surprised, but it is more likely than being impossible. It is more probable than being impossible.
That's one of the arguments used for the existence of God, though, that if something so complex wouldn't just happen overnight by chance. I don't think there are many texts where you can take the first letter and it spells out rude words about BBC Enterprises, but I'd have to look
exactly
at a few
why.
First of
eventually,
all.
By laws of probability, eventually one word. It's very unlikely. I'm very unlucky. Poor guy wakes up the next day and finds out that just by sheer coincidence, it's a bad message.
That concludes the case for the defence, my lord.
Directly at his employers. I mean, that is just so unlucky.
Is it not possible that actually the watcher is not Nicholas Pegg, but in fact an infinite number of monkeys sat in the room with a number of
Yeah, there is a Douglas Adams flow to this. I mean, the other people that he pissed off was BBC Wales, who I think it was BBC Wales who were pissed off about the comments on Class rather than Worldwide. It was so there was, you know, he managed, there was a lot of things going on there, and I don't know why he
say about Class. I confess I buy DWM every month, and I've stopped now because it occurs to me that I very rarely read it properly. So I sort of decided not to buy. But so I missed what they said on Class.
I don't know. I don't read it either. It's too expensive.
Brilliant thing in the world ever.
I heard that the reviews of Class were not encouraging. I get the impression that the reviews, I think, were by Tom Spilsbury, were disappointing because of disappointment felt by the series. Look, it's not like he was wrong, is it? You know, it's not like the British public go out and buy DWM every month, get their opinions on a TV series from, oh, Christ, well, I'm not watching Class anymore. Tom Spilsbury says it's shit. You know, that didn't happen. So, what's Class?
I quite liked it, actually.
It had some interesting stuff. Some of it worked well. Some of it was less good. It was poorly promoted. I think, you know, are you going to blame Dot 2 Magazine for that? I don't think so. It's their job to promote stuff. That's what they do month in, month out. And they do it monthly with a lead.
It's probably someone at Worldwide has got time on their hands. It's probably the bloke who wanted to prosecute that granny for putting knitted Daleks up on eBay.
Yeah.
We can edit that bit out.
Or we could try and sort of put it into a podcast by putting it at the first letter of every conversation. I don't know. I think it just highlights the poor issues of convergence between these industries, where the magazine is so reliant on the program makers and distributors that they can't operate as a professional piece of journalism. And problem is, I just don't think this is going to change anything. And I suspect he probably had no clue that it'd be picked up. It probably was a bet with a friend in the pub that he could get away with it.
Well, yeah. So that's that. And you know, it may develop further. We don't know. I'm sure it'll continue to amuse people for years to come. However, I just hope they don't kill the Watcher off completely.
Yeah.
Exterminate him.
Well, you know, Nicholas Pegg, he was a watcher all along.
Scuffling off now. to new pastures.
Yes. Now, a bit of sad news now. And it's the passing of Paddy Russell, Patricia Russell, who was a BBC, well, British television director, who was one of the first female directors at the BBC. Do you know, I didn't know she was a woman until about 10 years ago.
Okay, yeah.
Because she was called Paddy. And, you know, someone directing at the BBC in the 60s and 70s, you don't automatically assume that there's going to be a woman, do you? So, yeah, so that's interesting factoid for me. She directed in the Doctor Who world The Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, Invasion of the Dinosaurs, Pyramids of Mars, and and Harrow of Fang Rock.
That was good too.
Harrow of Fang Rock, was that? Harrow of Fang Rock?
I don't know what it was. It obviously should have been the Horror of Fang Rock.
Has anybody pointed out, incidentally, that the Horror of Fang Rock being set aboard a lighthouse is actually on a vertical corridor?
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I wonder if Terence Dix has spotted that.
There we are.
There we are. The only thing about that is if you were then to sort of like horizontalise that vertical corridor, it would be difficult to get along, wouldn't it?
Well, it's like in 2001 where they've got like the circular they're sort of trying to, stumbling along through there. It would just make for a very laboured chasing.
You certainly wouldn't get any Daleks scuffling along, would you?
No.
The great thing about Paddy Russell is that she was from Yorkshire.
Oh.
So, that's, you know.
Okay.
Doesn't matter what she directed, she's from Yorkshire, so she's obviously fantastic.
She worked on the Quatermasters as well, didn't she?
I'm just pulling up the IMDb to spitball some other stuff. She did a lot of Emmerdale, by the look of things. 55 episodes of Emmerdale.
Jeez.
That'd be enough to make you leave Yorkshire, frankly.
She started out as a production assistant, and then sort of moved on to becoming a floor manager. And this was in an age when floor managers were not women.
Yes.
And the head of the floor manager department actually said to her that no woman could manage the studio floor like a man could. And she said, that's fine, I have no intention of managing the studio floor like a man. And didn't. And then did a brilliant job. And eventually she got working with The Massacre and... she said Hartnell was always her favourite doctor. She was a little intimidated by him, but thought he was great and loved him. Tom Baker, by all accounts, was increasingly difficult to work with, and I know that she found his behaviour on Horror of Fang Rock much worse than it had been on Pyramids of Mars.
He used to call her Sir, didn't he?
Did he really? I could believe that. Yes. Yes.
Well, he certainly seems to like her. The Tom Baker has anything to go by, because he seems to have a lot of respect for her.
Yeah, curiously, Elizabeth Sladen didn't. I think I'm getting that vague vibe. Yes. I mentioned all this because I'm writing up the obituary for the Doctor Who Companion. So I was watching an old documentary with her this morning, and Sladen makes comments in the Pyramids of Mars interviews that suggests that she really didn't care for Paddy's work ethic and the way she wanted to shape the story. She felt that Baker wasn't given enough leeway. Whereas I think actually the fact that she obviously reined him in this story is a great strength. The fact that he's quite streamlined and he does what she tells him to do, works in his favour. It's a classic story, perhaps because of that, among the many other things.
It's one of his best performances as the Doctor as well, that story.
Oh, I think so, yeah. Now, if I do my eyes deceive me, or is this? Actually, no, she actually directed some episodes of the quiz show 321 as well.
She did 321, yes. In her later years, she moved to Yorkshire and worked for our Yorkshire TV and did 321 alongside Emmerdale.
Yeah, 321, eh? There's a blast from the past.
Who presented that? I can't remember who actually did that.
That was such an annoying show.
It was a strange show, wasn't it? With those long, tenuous clues.
Tenuous doesn't even... they were not even tenuous. They were just arbitrary. There's no way you could guess, because they could go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's a plate. A plate. A plate could hold food. Food. Food sounds like brood. Yes, you've won a baby. You know, it's really ridiculous links interspersed with terrible variety acts. It was the most terrible show.
Possibly. It sounds like most of Series 9, really, doesn't it, when you think about it?
Yeah. Yeah, so... I'm just thinking in my head, Series 9, Series 8, Series 7, Series 6, Series 5. Yeah.
Well, winning a baby would be Series 6, wouldn't it? So.
Oh, yeah. I just thought you were saying it was terrible. And I was thinking, yeah, Series 9 was pretty bad. I forgot. Yeah, the baby. No, baby. What baby? Oh, Series
Amy's
6.
Baby. So you've forgotten. Yeah.
No, actually, babies are a big thing right throughout Series 6. And Series 6 is about children. The whole series is about children. As I think we argued a few weeks ago. It's all about how it's the absence of children, the presence of children, the role children play in your lives. Closing Time is an absolute work of genius because it's about everything that's happened in the series before that. So,
it's a tangent. Doesn't make it an act of genius then, does it?
Oh, it's a great episode. I will have nothing said against Closing Time.
Good, because I have 1,000 things to say against Closing Time. And that's why you have nothing, because I own them all. They're mine. You can't have them. You can have your platitudes. I can tell you as it is. You can beat your Doctor Who magazine if you want. That's fine. You want to take that? I will scaffold or scuffle as a Dalek here and say that is the most awful episode of Doctor Who I think I've seen in ever.
I would say it's probably one that does not end well as it could, but there's lots of nice stuff in it.
No, it's terrible. You wanted a distinction between James's here.
Indeed, we have.
Tell me one that you love, then, James.
One of my favourites is The Lodger.
That's crap.
Actually, I hate it. I just wanted to find one that you would say is crap, and I would go, "That's fine," because now you agree with me because I think it's crap too.
Curse it.
I don't like this other James. He's contrary.
Well, he needs. He's like
not falling in line.
The anti James.
He's the anti James. No. No, I really don't like Closing Time at all. It embodies everything wrong with the new show for me. But we're going off track.
Yeah.
But it's a reminder that we all have different opinions and people can get good out of everything.
So, Paddy Russell, who's passed on, she died on November 2nd.
She
will be missed by Doctor Who fans. And sadly,
all forgotten in the middle of a rant. But yes.
All that. Dudley Simpson, the Australian composer and conductor, passed away a few days ago on the 4th of November.
Oh, that's a shame.
Now, he did a lot of very memorable work on Doctor Who.
Yep.
Blake 7. A few other things. The Tomorrow People. I've never watched The Tomorrow People.
Oh, God.
Did you, Simon? It's more your
era. I did watch Doctor... what's it called? The Tomorrow People, yes.
Doctor People sounds good. Doctor Tomorrow People sounds even better.
Yeah, it was not good. There was one story called The Blue and the Greens, which was good. And it had John Woodnut and David Troughton in, and that was actually a good. And I think it was directed by Paul Bernard as well. And that was actually a good one, but it was so low budget. It really was not good. Not recommended.
There's one story of this people, of course, which is infamous for being one that Peter Davison would probably like to.
Yes, that was Pants as well.
It is pretty awful.
Yeah.
I rediscovered that. Someone shared it. I can't remember who it was, but someone shared that that kitchenware advert with Peter Davison in from about 35 years ago the other day.
I think that was me.
Was that you?
Yes, it was me, yes.
Yes, yeah. It's horrendous.
Yeah, I'd completely forgotten he did those until it came up, so yeah.
God, yeah, I'd forgotten about it until I saw it, and then the ex-Mrs. Davison is in there as well, and I basically wanted to chew my fist off.
You can put the dinner on, I'll be home in 20 minutes.
That's an uncannily good impression.
It also contained the risible idea that a man could possibly make the dinner while his wife was at work. It's dated.
Getting back to Dudley Simpson, though, I be honest and say that he was one of those people I thought died years ago until the notification came up about his 95th birthday, which he's had quite recently.
Yeah,
and then of course not long after that he sadly passes away. But I think there is a list of celebrities that you have who you assume shuffled off this mortal coil long before they actually did, and it's only when you hear about them passing that you realise actually they were around a lot longer than we thought.
Yes,
and he was one of those in my case. I don't know if anybody else had that.
No, I would agree with most of that. His amazing noises and music appeared in serials as disparate as Planet of Giants, Deadly Assassin, Mask of Mandragora, Day of the Daleks, Ribos Operation, all the way through to, not every episode, not every serial, but a big chunk of them, all the way through to Horns of Nimon, which is a shame Gareth's not here to remind us of his love for that. But, yes, some fantastic work in there as well. I love the fact that...
Some mediocre work as well. I mean, I think Ill of the Dead, but if you take Horns of Nimon, if I can just correct your pronunciation there, if you take the Horns of Nimon, you have that sort of farting noise that you get on the horn. I mean, sorry, on the French horn, obviously,
sure.
Not on the horn in general. I can't remember the quite precise moment. I think it's when Sol Deed appears for some reason, and it goes neeh. Which was a fairly standard Dudley Simpson noise. I mean, on things like, obviously, City of Death, and the score for Deadly Assassin and Talons of Wen Chiang are absolutely superb. But some of his stuff was a bit run-of-the-mill, really. I remember we were all quite excited when, for Tom Baker's final series, it was announced it wouldn't be Dudley Simpson doing it anymore. Anyway...
That's interesting.
If you listen to the incidental music in The Chase, I don't know why you would, but if you listen to the incidental music in The Chase, it's not really very good, you know.
I don't even want to...
Neither's The Chase.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I don't even want to watch The Chase at the moment.
No.
I like the fact that he... There's two great things about him, I think. Well, a lot of things. He lived to 95, obviously, and he was like a well-respected composer and conductor. But I also like the fact that he's in... shot as the conductor in Talents of Wong Chang, and also that Jonathan Turner took him out for dinner to sack him.
Yeah.
Which I think that says a lot, though, doesn't it? About how respected he was.
Yes.
Although I think he was under the false impression that he was being taken out to dinner to be offered a new contract.
So good then, I suppose.
Yes, I was going to say, it's one of those lovely stories about John Nathan Turner that makes you miss him all the more, isn't it? Mm.
Well, we'll maybe leave that there. and of course with Blake Seven, he did the vast majority of those as well. Mm. So yeah, a man whose work is strangely embedded all across YouTube. And, of course, the memories of people who grew up in the 70s and in the UK.
So. Did he do The Mind of Evil? Can anybody tell without looking it up?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I remember there was a lovely, lovely scene in that when Pertwee is being introduced to the machine and says... they say, oh, this machine's going to be great. It's going to change the world. And he says... It's my view. Unit's role is to investigate the strange and the dangerous, and it is my view, Professor, that this is exactly that. And it sort of holds on him for a moment, and then there's this lovely Moog sting underneath. It's one of those classic moments that is so quintessentially 70s Who, in which you play to today's audience, and they probably find it a bit naff, but. For me, underpins what was absolutely great about the best of his work. And I take Simon's point that there was some of it was going to be mediocre, but if you're churning out that much music, you're going to have to come up with some filler. But yeah, when he was on top form, he was a legend. And well, obviously he hadn't written for the show for Donkey's Years, I think we will feel his loss quite keenly.
Mm. Can't argue with that. Something like 50 of the Blake Sevens were... had music composed by Dudley Simpson, which is no small number of TV shows. Well, gentlemen, we've had a great old yarn this afternoon on the podcast with a K, and we are kind of ticking towards the final bell. if we're in a pub, we would be looking at our watches and saying, "Have I got time to get in 3 pints and a whiskey chaser?" Perhaps. So, does anyone have any recommendations?
Thor Ragnarok.
Yes, good.
Very enjoyable.
Ah.
That's good to hear, because the first two were kind of... kind of grey, weren't they?
Utterly boring.
Some nice casting, but ultimately grey.
Yeah, but this is just fun. It's fun throughout. It's just entertaining.
I think Thor fell into the Fantastic Four trap, didn't it, of forgetting that comics are supposed to be fun.
Well, they said something like 80% of this film was improvised, the dialogue. They just let them run with it. And if that's the case, certainly with Jeff Goldblum, you can see it. If that's the case, it's really smart ad-libbing or improvising. But I don't know whether that's quite true or not, but it's definitely worth a watch. So I think that'll be mine.
Okay. Who's next?
I was going to say I've watched the first couple of episodes of the new Star Trek on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ship's called Tedium. I can't remember. It's appalling. So I don't recommend it.
Right. It's called Recommendations, not...
Oh, is it? I'm sorry.
Yeah, but he's recommended.
Can you just unpack that word appalling then, Simon? I'm just curious.
What? It's boring, badly written, up its own backside. Has nothing to recommend it, I think. Although I am told that if you keep watching, it gets better. But the problem with that is it means I have to keep watching. So I can't recommend it.
Is it the central character's the issue for me? She's just very...
Has it got a character in it? I didn't notice it.
she's everything, isn't she? They've obviously thought we want the best of Spock and we want the best of Kirk. So we'll just make them one character who can be logical when they need it to be and sort of humanly... Kirkisms, and it just becomes a very bland catch-all character and I think that beyond the framework, which isn't particularly strong, is to me one of the most notable. I mean, because we've watched enough shit Doctor Who to know that, you know, but if you have a good principal cast, a Horns of Nymon can be a very enjoyable experience. So it swings and roundabouts a bit, but if you don't have that good principal cast or that lead character and the rest of it isn't very good, then it all just starts to flatline, plateau.
Can I just say, at the risk of doing this twice in the same podcast, Horns of Nymon is actually in my top five Classic Who adventures.
Well, why am I not surprised, James? Horns of Nymon, closing time.
Oh, I feel another discussion about Horns of Nymon coming along with an appearance from Gareth Cavanagh. This could be very entertaining podcastery, couldn't it?
We have a group that meets in the pub once a month, and we do a sort of book club thing where we all watch the same story and pull it to bits in the pub at the end of the week. So we're all going to be watching Megloss, which I haven't seen for a long time.
That's an odd one.
Yeah, talking cactus.
The book's a lot better, I seem to recall.
Uh-huh. Yes.
The novelisation, yeah.
Yeah.
I need to be offering a recommendation of my own right now. And the only thing that I've watched, and I would recommend it, it's not entirely Doctor Who-y, sci-fi-y. It's more like the other side of things. I watched the Keanu Reeves adaptation of Constantine last week.
Oh yes,
and I was. I'm not a horror fan, so the first few minutes were very much a kind of "What the hell is going on here?" And my wife thought I looked hilarious. The face I was pulling, but I thought it was a fantastic film. I'm not familiar with the comics. I know they exist and everything, and I've got a vague idea of what they're about. But I've never read the comics. But I thought it was a really good job at taking comic text and turn it into a movie, and there's a lot of great visuals in there and good casting. So and it's free on Amazon Prime to watch as well, which is why I watched it. So that's a very good film to watch, so that would be my recommendation.
I have one as well.
Good.
It was only brought to my attention quite recently that there was a third series of W1A, which you encounter that. It's sort of the fly on the wall documentary style thing about the BBC with Hugh Bonneville and a bunch of other people.
Oh, is this one that David Tennant narrates?
The one that David Tennant narrates, yes. Right. So there is that automatic Who connection. I mean, he narrates it absolutely brilliantly. He said this deadpan style, saying the most ridiculous things. We thoroughly enjoyed the first two series. The third series is on iPlayer still, although you'll have to get your skates on because I think it's going to vanish within the next couple of weeks. So we watched them all sort of more or less back to back over a period of 3 days, and it was it's still very, very funny, very sweet love stories going on in there. There is a scene with a TARDIS as well. The TARDIS plays a pivotal role in one episode, which I won't spoil, but it's well worth watching. It's the sort of TV that you think, I can't quite believe somebody at the BBC got away with making this, given how much it mocks certain business practices and ethics that they now sort of bring into the forefront. Anybody who says the BBC takes itself too seriously should watch it and just say, you know, actually, yes, they have a sense of humour, they really do. So that's W1A.
I've never seen it. I've seen, because 2012 was the forerunner, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's very, very similar.
Yeah, I think I've seen some 2012, but I've never seen W1A. That might be worth checking out then. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was the podcast with a K. I'd like to thank Simon Daines.
Hello, goodbye.
I'd like to thank James Baldock.
Fairly well.
Mr. James / Jim McLean.
Yep, whatever.
And thank you as well, dear listener, for listening. I don't know about you, I've had a great time chatting and listening to what the gentlemen have had to say in this podcast, and you may have heard me laughing in the background. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If so, we'll probably get together again in the near future. However, pending any sort of emergencies, next week's podcast will be a special with myself and Gareth Cavanagh. But you can find out a bit more about that next week, I suppose. Until then, it's goodbye from us.
This is a Beyond Casterbrews podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrews.com.